Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We begin with the overheated reaction to the President's gun control initiative from members of Congress and speak with Jonathan Lowy, the director of the Legal Action Project at the Brady Center to Prevent Gun Violence, to assess the chances of Congress passing any measures that would curb the epidemic of gun violence in America. Then, with the arrival of West African troops in Mali following a military deployment by the French, we will discuss an intervention that the West sees as a war against Al-Qaeda and Malians see as a war against the Tuareg. Ni Akute, an independent Africa policy researcher, joins us to discuss what is at stake in the region where an attempt by the Algerian military to rescue Western hostages taken in retaliation against the French resulted in many killed in the crossfire and some missing. Then finally, we'll be joined in the studio by three campaign finance reform activists who are part of this weekend's Money Out Voters In Day of Action that will take place in 76 cities and 33 states on the third anniversary of the Supreme Court's Citizens United ruling. Mary Beth Fielder, the founder of the Los Angeles Money Out Voters In Coalition, and Kai Newkirk, a founding organizer of 99 Rise, and Lauren Windsor, the host of The Undercurrent, a grassroots political TV web show on the Young Turks Network, will discuss the upcoming Day of Action. Joining us now is Jonathan Lowy, the director of the Legal Action Project at the Brady Center to Prevent Gun Violence. He leads a team of attorneys in providing pro bono legal representation to victims of gun violence. For over a decade, he has litigated lawsuits against gun manufacturers, dealers, and owners where guns have not been made, sold, or stored responsibly, as well as attacks on gun laws on Second Amendment grounds. He represented several victims of the D.C. area snipers who settled for $2.5 million against a gun dealer and manufacturer, the first case in which a gun manufacturer had paid damages for a criminal shooting resulting from alleged negligent distribution. And he represented two New Jersey police officers who recovered $1 million in a settlement against the dealer who sold the guns used to shoot them. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jonathan Lowy.
I'm happy to be here, Ian.
And Vice President today in the White House, speaking to 300 mayors, said he has no illusions about the fight ahead. Meanwhile, there's been some overheated, somewhat irrational statements from a lot of members of Congress. The passions on the anti-gun control side are quite palpable. Is there resolve on the other side that can at least match some of this passion?
There definitely is. I mean, I've been working for sensible gun violence prevention measures for 15 years now, and I've never seen the sort of commitment and dedication and demand for sensible measures, both in the public, where we've just had a huge outpouring of support, and on Capitol Hill. I was at a hearing on the Hill yesterday, and they literally did not have enough chairs to fit the members of Congress who wanted to be attending and just to be a part of a hearing discussing gun violence prevention measures. So I really think this time it's different.
Well, but there was a hearing that Nancy Pelosi held that was a Democratic caucus hearing. It wasn't an official congressional hearing because the Republican chairs of the relevant committees refused to hold hearings. So what hearing are you talking about?
You're exactly correct. I shouldn't have said hearing. It was the Democratic Party's version of a hearing. So it was not an official hearing. But what you saw was tremendous support among the Democratic caucus. And while I do understand that, of course, you will need some Republican support, at the end of the day, I really think it's going to be a untenable position for Republicans, particularly after Sandy Hook, to stand before their constituents come election time and explain why it was important for them to fight for the rights of felons to buy guns without a background check, or to fight for the rights of people to get AK-47s or 30-round ammunition magazines, which is what we will be debating. And I don't care what district you're in. I don't care how red it is. I don't care how many gun owners are there. Taking those arguments is a loser in America today.
Well, so far they have been a winning argument. The NRA has dominated and intimidated the Congress. They have continually told the world that they stand up for protecting the rights of law-abiding citizens, when behind the scenes, through their legislation like the Tihard Amendment, etc., they actually end up protecting criminals, because they prevent the ATF from tracking guns used in crimes. And a gun used in a crime is already bloodstained. That is not anything to do with law-abiding citizens, and yet law enforcement can't track these. So a lot of the initiatives that the president announced the other day were executive orders hoping to revive the ATF. I spoke yesterday with William Vizard, who was a special agent with the ATF, and I must say, Jonathan Lowy, he was pretty skeptical about the chances of getting anything through the Congress. So give me some good news.
Well, there's a few pieces of good news, and I'm realistic about it. I'm just optimistic. And one thing is, what we know for a fact now is that the NRA does not speak for gun owners. They don't even speak for their own members. 74% of NRA members support universal background checks. So now that is out in the open. And the NRA cannot deliver the votes that they say they do. We've also just gone through an election cycle where the NRA did spend millions of dollars, but over 99% of that money went to losing candidates. And they've had that sort of abysmal success rate for a number of election cycles now. And I think the message is setting in, that the NRA, they're speaking for a very vocal but very small minority and an industry. And I think that that's ultimately going to lead at least enough Republicans to get some of this legislation passed.
Well, Jonathan Lowy, they're both vocal and somewhat rabid. I mean, the commercial that they've made that attacks the children of the president and suggests that Obama is a hypocrite because his children are protected by the Secret Service and he's unwilling to have vigilantes in every school in America armed to protect school children. So that's, most people consider it beyond the pale, and it's always, there's always been understood in Washington that the families of the first family are off limits. And yet when they're confronted by it, the head of the NRA acts as though they haven't said it. I mean, they don't really come across very well, but apparently to their own audience, they do. I mean, there's a big disconnect here.
Well, I think a lot of what the NRA leader does makes sense if you understand that what they're trying to do is sell guns, and particularly given a declining percentage of the American people who own guns, what they're really trying to do is sell even more guns to people who already have a lot of guns. I mean, that's where a lot of the gun sales happen. I was speaking at a group, and a guy came up to me and said he had 10 assault weapons and was going to go out and buy 5 or 10 more. So they really are trying to appeal to a very, very small group to gin up sales, which will help the industry that they're trying to defend. But that's not a lot of votes, and that's why you see things like 74% of NRA members supporting universal background checks, majorities of NRA members supporting other sensible reforms. And that reality, I really do think, is setting in Congress.
Again, I'm speaking with Jonathan Lowy, the director of the Legal Action Project at the Brady Center to Prevent Gun Violence. And over the years, Jonathan, I've spoken to a number of members of your organization, including Paul Helmke, that used to head it up. And he was a former mayor of Fort Wayne, Indiana. And he had mentioned that the mayors in this country and the police chiefs in this country are the ones that are really fed up with the NRA because their police officers are being outgunned by criminals who have a free rein because the NRA prevents any sensible gun laws from restricting the sale of powerful military-style firearms. So what's happening with building that alliance? I mean, obviously the vice president had the mayors in the White House today. It's pretty easy to put two and two together there.
Certainly the mayors in huge numbers support sensible gun measures and been right at the forefront of this fight. And law enforcement also has been very involved, and I see them getting even more involved, particularly given the assault weapon legislation that's now on the table. Because as you say, in 1994, when there was a successful push for a federal assault weapons ban, law enforcement was front and center fighting for that because they are the responders who actually have to face those weapons out on the streets. And we've seen since the ban lapsed numerous cases where law enforcement officers have been gunned down. They've been outgunned by the criminals. And so I think in the coming days and weeks, you're going to see them stepping up even more prominently.
So, Jonathan Lowy, the president, when he made his announcement a couple of days ago with some of the families of the victims of the shooting in Sandy Hook, he closed the event by talking about the painting that a parent of one of the young kids that was killed had given him, and how it keeps reminding him. It's in his study, reminding him of this young life cut short and the life that she could have had, and he spoke with great eloquence and resolve, but he did say that it's really up to the American people ultimately. Because the thing that I find extraordinary about this is the NRA, for all of their bragging about their membership, they have roughly 4 million or less probably members, and that's basically about 1% of the entire population of America. So they are the 1%. What about the 99%? What is there any kind of coherent plan out there to organize them, or is it just the sort of ad hoc, the mayors and whatever else? And because I sense that there's not a lasting anti-gun constituency in this country, certainly not one with the passions that the pro-gun people have.
Well, I can tell you that at Brady, we've been fighting this fight for almost 40 years, and our major focus always has been, and certainly is today, to bring the voice of the American people to bear. We're not a collection of mayors who are great on this issue. We're not politicians. We are representing the voice of the American people, many of them victims of gun violence themselves. They've always been at the forefront of our organization and are today. And so that's really what we're about. That's where we see certainly one of our primary roles. We have a website, wearebetterthanthis.org, which brings together a lot of people, and we're going to be continuing to lead campaigns to make sure the public remains engaged on this issue, which I would tell your listeners is going to be a long fight. I mean, there's a short-term fight, and we certainly hope that we can pass some sensible legislation in the coming weeks or months. But that's not going to end gun violence in America. It's going to help end it. It's going to save lives. But this is a long struggle that we're going to have to be engaged in. And I really think that there's a new energy among the American people. I do think the Sandy Hook massacre was a tipping point, and I don't think we're going back.
Well, just in the last couple of minutes, Jonathan Lowy, the Ku Klux Klan were put out of business by the Southern Poverty Law Center through litigation. They found that was their Achilles heel, to sue them out of business. And Although the NRA is a noxious organization, I'm not suggesting it's the same as the Ku Klux Klan. However, is there a way, given that you have successfully sued on behalf of victims of the D.C. area sniper, who settled for $2.5 million against the gun dealer and manufacturer in that case, and then you also represented two New Jersey police officers who recovered $1 million in a settlement against the dealer who sold the gun that was used to shoot them. So is there any recourse, for example, for all the families of those children that were shot up by an assault rifle in Connecticut?
There may be, and I'm certainly, I'll be frank, I've talked to attorneys about that, and we always look at these sorts of cases. I represent, and we represent victims of gun violence across the country, and have for over 20 years. And that is another way to reform the gun industry. We bring cases to hold irresponsible gun companies accountable, to send a message to the gun industry. It's the way they do business. They do some outrageous things. Most gun dealers are responsible business people, but there are a few really bad apples. There's a case where we represent a young man who was shot with a gun that was trafficked because a gun dealer sold 87 Saturday night special handguns in one transaction, all cash. And what do you know? Those guns were not intended to defend the gun owner's family or household. They were going to be used to be sold on the streets to criminals. And we argued that was negligent, and that's in the courts now. It's the sort of thing that happens, which leads to gun violence in the criminal gun market. So that is an important part of the puzzle.
Well, but if the ATF were the shackles were taken off the ATF that the NRA through their representatives in Congress have put on the ATF, one of them is that the ATF can't monitor gun dealers. Once a year they can visit them. I mean, it's outrageous how little the very case that you're talking about. If the ATF were your ally in this and be able to track those guns, and because apparently it's only about 1% of the dealers, gun dealers out there that sell to criminals, most of the guns to criminals, I should say.
That's right. And in fact, 86% of gun dealers sell no crime guns. So it's very important that ATF have the powers of any other law enforcement agency. And because of the gun lobby's supporters in Congress, as you say, they're restricted in all sorts of ways. And Congress has also shielded the public and even public officials from getting full information about how gun violence is caused in this country. They've prevented CDC from studying gun violence as a public health problem. They've also prevented the public and public officials from getting crime gun data to see which gun dealers are supplying the crime gun market. These are restrictions that make absolutely no sense except to protect the worst of the worst in the gun industry. And the president proposed eliminating some of these. Congress can go farther, should go farther, sure, and eliminate all of them.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Jonathan Lowy.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Jonathan Lowy, the director of the Legal Action Project at the Brady Center to Prevent Gun Violence. He leads a team of attorneys in providing pro bono legal representation to victims of gun violence. For over a decade, he's litigated lawsuits against gun manufacturers, dealers, and owners where guns have not been made, sold, or stored responsibly, as well as attacks on gun laws on Second Amendment grounds. He represented several victims of the D.C. area snipers who settled for $2.5 million against a gun dealer and manufacturer, the first case in which a gun manufacturer manufacturer has paid damages for a criminal shooting resulting from alleged negligent distribution. He also represented two New Jersey police officers who recovered $1 million in a settlement against the dealer who sold the gun used to shoot them. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking about what's happening in Mali, and also we will look into the botched hostage rescue in Algeria.
He changed his clothes and shined his boots and combed his dark hair down, and his mother cried as he walked out, "Don't take your guns to town, son, leave your guns at home, Bill. Don't take your guns to town." He laughed and kissed his mom and said, "You're Billy Joe's a man. I can shoot it."
Nenwa fofo muni, nenwa novio muni, nenwa mekhlo muni, nenwa dada muni. Ye kwem la no soma. Ye kula no se, 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 kula no se.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Nia Akwete, who is a D.C.-based independent policy researcher who monitors the impact of U.S. and global policies and actions on Africa and helps integrate Africa's several diasporas. He frequently appears on Al Jazeera and testifies to the United States Congress, and previously he was executive director of Africa Action, founder of the Democracy and Conflict Research Institute in Accra, Ghana, founding executive director of the West Africa arm of the Soros Foundation in Nigeria, and professor of African studies at Georgetown University, and editor and research director at Trans-Africa Forum. Welcome to Background Briefing, Nia Akwete.
It's such a pleasure to be back again. Thanks for having me.
Now, I was just watching you on Al Jazeera last night in a roundtable discussion on both what's happening in Mali, and of course that's been complicated by what's just been happening in Algeria, where a bunch of oil workers were captured by so-called Al-Qaeda in the Maghreb, and it looks like the Algerian army, in trying to rescue them, has killed quite a number of the Western hostages. Give us a sense to begin with, what is this relationship between the AQIM and the Tuaregs in Mali, and also the what's happening in terms of the Algerian government? Are they exporting their problem? Is that what's going on?
It's such a complicated relationship, and so I will try to simplify it as much as time and circumstances allow. But there will be nuances that we will sort of slide over. Yes, you know, the AQIM, Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb, it is largely an Algerian terrorist group. I use the word terrorist advisedly because sometimes you smear Islam unfairly when you call them Islamists, because they don't always behave as if they believe in even Islam. Okay, so they use their religious mantle, but they are very... They are a fighting group that fought against the Algerian government. Now, to give them a little bit of credit, because I'm largely against them, but you have their origin is that in the early 90s, they were cheated. They were then just an Islam group competing for politics in Algeria. They were about to win the elections, and with the support of the U.S. and the French, the Algerian generals canceled the elections and stole the elections. And so the Islamists started fighting. They lost that fight, but the remnants, the die-hard remnants, losing the fight in Algeria, went down into Mali. Algeria shares a long border in the Sahara Desert with Mali, Mali to the south of Algeria, just like maybe the U.S. and Mexico. And they went down into Mali and created a base there. They went through different names, and this was early 1990s. But after 9/11, and after Osama bin Laden, they were mad at the French and their American allies. So they took opportunity of 9/11 and made an alliance with Al-Qaeda and Osama bin Laden and changed their name to AQIM, Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb. Then, of course, you have the Tuaregs, who are an ethnic community in northern Mali, and Mali became independent in 1960. By 1962, the Tuaregs had started fighting against the government in Bamako. The Tuaregs remind me of the Kurds in the Middle East because they are spread across three countries, Algeria, Mali, and Niger. So they fought all three countries, but this we will focus on Mali. They had been fighting for more than 50 years against the government. Fast forward to Libya, when Gaddafi was overthrown, the Tuaregs, who were there as a unit fighting for Gaddafi, went back into Mali heavily armed, and exactly a year ago today, January 17, 2012, they attacked, they rekindled the war, and they took the town of Menaka near the Algerian border. And since then, they've been fighting the government. So the three are very much linked. Now, in terms of the hostage situation in Algeria, it is very tragic. It's heartbreaking. But I think that if one has been following the situation, it shouldn't be too surprising. Number one, because the French went into Mali last Friday, 6 days ago. And I think with good reason. And to... You know, I think as critical as I am of Western intervention, of the U.S. intervention, and especially of French interventions, I think the French intervention in Mali last week is an exception. I make an exception for it. It is the least bad of the options. But once they went in, the groups that are now fighting the Malian government, they've taken over about 70% of Mali. Frankly, if France hadn't gone in, I think the groups would have taken over all of Mali by now. And so France blocked them. Of course, they didn't like it. So they issued a lot of threats. And they said France was opening the gates of hell. So what has just happened in eastern Algeria, on the border with Libya, with the taking of the hostages and the tragedy, to me, yes, it is them hitting back. I hope I haven't confused the situation too much, but I think those are some of the elements.
No, you haven't. And, of course, what you're talking about, in essence, here, Nia Kwete, again, a D.C.-based independent policy researcher who monitors the impact of U.S. and global policies and actions on Africa, you're basically describing asymmetrical warfare. And aren't we in for more of that? As much as the French military seem to have stopped the advance of mostly Tuaregs. I mean, it's a broader struggle between France and the West against Al-Qaeda, but yes, internally in Mali itself, it is a part of a long-standing battle between the South and the Tuaregs in the North. Is that right?
That is very correct. And you are also, quite on the money in saying that this is asymmetrical warfare. It is not a matter of saying, okay, France is going to conquer this particular city and then the fight is over. Nothing like that. So you are quite right, and that is worrisome. But here is where, I'm holding, figuratively, I'm holding my nose and saying, okay, if you give me a choice between the four groups, the four militias, the MNLA, the Tuareg Fighting Force, which wants independence in the north, plus the three jihadist groups that they are allied with, they are fighting the government of Mali, and they've taken most of Mali. So if my choice is, let these four groups take over Mali, and what will happen thereafter versus support the French, or at least understand why it's better for the French to step in and stop the militias, takeover of Mali, then I side with the French. But it is only because it is the worst, the least bad of those two options. And that is why I support it. But you are right. It is very dangerous. It can lead to a whole number of things. Is there an end in sight? Not really, but one other reason why I think that even progressives like me, Pan-Africanists, anti-imperialists, who are very suspicious of the 500 years of Western and European interventions and wars in Africa and third world countries, that suspicion and opposition to any intervention is well placed. I am just pleading that this is an exception. And the reason it is an exception is this. If we have only two choices as of last week when the French went in, if you do nothing, the situation is going to be much worse. So it's not as if you say, well, look, we shouldn't intervene. My point is, if we don't intervene, of all the things that are bad things that are happening now, all of the things that we can imagine happening now, from France manipulating the government, going for because of resources, and all the hostage taking and terror activities, all of that, I'm saying, are credible and could happen. But my fear is the alternative. If there was no intervention, effective intervention, what would have happened is that by now they would have taken over Mali. Speculation, of course, but I think it's informed speculation. And if they take over Mali, all of West Africa will be inflamed and destabilized. I kid you not. I mean, from Senegal all the way to Nigeria, in my view, and this is just West Africa, and it could have jumped to East Africa. And I'm not exaggerating. I genuinely have that fear. I also think you have to look at, okay, we need to look at what are the Malians themselves, what do they feel about this? What do they feel about the presence of the French? What do the West Africans feel? What do all of Africa, the African Union, feel? And I can tell you, Ian, that if we were to do a good, serious poll of Malians, of West Africans, and of all Africans, I think I will bet that in Mali, you will get like 90% support. In the rest of Africa, you'll get 99% support. Because what the Africans are saying is Mali is on fire. West Africa will soon be on fire. We can't put out the fire ourselves. They've been begging for a year for international support. They didn't get it. Finally, France arrives at the last moment. So all of them are praising the French for coming in. Now, frankly, I wish the Americans, as much as I'm an anti-imperialist and a leftist, I would have actually preferred the Americans for this reason only. As I said on Al Jazeera last night, the United States has a tradition of civil society, African Americans, progressives, the anti-war movement. They hold the government's feet to the fire, from Vietnam to the civil rights movement, to the anti-apartheid movement. There are people and traditions that if the U.S. government gets involved in Africa, they say, we are going to watch what you are doing. We will make you do the right thing. Plus the fact that the current president's father is an African. The French have gone in, and temporarily I am a little relieved because they are blocking the takeover of all of Mali. But France doesn't have that tradition of French civil society forcing their government to pull back from misadventures, okay? The French were in Vietnam, and they pulled back only because the Vietnamese beat them. The United States was forced out of Vietnam by Americans. So I would have liked that the Americans have done it, and that would have been my fourth option, by the way. I think my first option would have been that Malians had been strong enough to resist these Islamist groups and even the Tuaregs, because I have sympathy. I'm a double minority. Ghana, where I'm from, I'm a minority. The United States, I'm a minority. So I really revere minority rights. But I don't think minority rights, except for extreme circumstances, should be done through war. Mali has been a democracy for the last 20 years. They could have slugged through their differences, but this particular group of Tuaregs who came from Libya, they were not interested in talking. They started a war. In fact, the president was overthrown because Malians were saying, you are not fighting them. You say you want to talk to them, but they are just deceiving you and killing our people. Okay, so I'm saying the Tuareg grievances should be sorted out through peaceful means, not through war. And so the Malians, if they had been strong, would have been good. The next preference for me would have been that the Africans could have helped Mali, and they did all they can. But they were also realistic in saying the problem is bigger than us. We want the world to help us. The world did not help them. I wish that the third option would have been the UN. The UN didn't do it, and I do fault the U.S. because the U.S. didn't take the problem seriously. Frankly, I think that even as we speak, the U.S. is not taking the problem seriously because it seems to me the thinking is, oh, it's just Africa. Oh, you know, who cares? If this was Europe, they would react differently. I give the French marks for taking it very seriously.
Well, I'm afraid we've run out of time here, and I thank you for your sort of history lesson going back to the Feast, the Islamic Salvation Front, who would have won the election in Algeria, then were brutally put down by the military government, but they became themselves so brutal that even the Algerian people turned against them. And the idea that the remnants of these psychotic Islamists, as they call themselves, are a part of this problem leads you to feel that it's not going to go away soon.
No, it's not. And I thank you for having me. I hope we get to do it again because it's a big problem. Next time I'll try to be simpler and clearer.
No problem. But we just don't have the time today, and I thank you so much for joining us.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Niyakweta. He's a DC-based independent policy researcher who monitors the impact of U.S. and global policies and actions on Africa and helps integrate Africa's several diasporas. He frequently appears on Al Jazeera and testifies to the United States Congress. And previously, he was executive director of Africa Action, founder of the Democracy and Conflict Research Institute in Accra, Ghana, founding executive director of the West African arm of the Soros Foundation in Nigeria, and professor of African studies at Georgetown University, and editor and research director at TransAfrica Forum. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back and joined in the studio by three campaign reform activists on the third anniversary of the Citizens United decision.
It's the money.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now in the studio are Mary Beth Fielder, Kai Newkirk, and Lauren Windsor. Mary Beth Fielder is a founder of the Los Angeles Money Out Voters In Coalition, an affiliation of groups dedicated to overturning Citizens United and passing a constitutional amendment that would eliminate corporate personhood and institute public campaign financing. She spearheaded the successful campaign to get the Los Angeles City Council to endorse this constitutional amendment. Kai Newkirk is a Los Angeles-based former union and community organizer. He is a founding organizer of 99 Rise, a movement dedicated to getting money out of politics. And Lauren Windsor is a multimedia journalist who blogs under the name Lady Libertine. She's also the host and producer of The Undercurrent, a grassroots political TV web show on the Young Turks Network. Welcome to Background Briefing, Mary Beth Fielder, Kai Newkirk, and Lauren Windsor.
Thanks, Ian.
Good to be here. Thanks.
Let me begin with you, Mary Beth, since you had some success yesterday with the Los Angeles City Council.
Yes, we did, Ian. On the heels of year ago in December, the City Council passed a resolution calling on Congress to amend the Constitution, which was a great victory. But yesterday, they went a step further. and actually have voted to put a ballot measure on the ballot in May during the mayoral campaign, which will give voters a chance to directly weigh in on the issue and vote yes or no on whether we should restore our power to regulate campaigns and whether corporations should have the same rights as human beings. So this is a great step forward because it's a much more powerful action to actually engage the voters. It's going to be a great opportunity to educate people and to build the movement. So we're really excited about what happened yesterday. And a big shout out to the LA City Council, who are a collection of wonderful elected officials.
And of course, this shows that there's activism happening. If things are stalled at the federal level, that doesn't mean there's not a lot of stuff happening at the local, county, and state levels in this country in terms of overturning Citizens United and getting money out of politics.
I mean, actually, there's a lot happening also on the federal level. There's quite a number of, I don't have the statistics right in front of me, but a lot of, I think it's 125 members of Congress have already called for a constitutional amendment. And there is 11 states that have called for an amendment, over 300 cities and towns, either through the state legislators putting it forward as they did in California, or through these direct ballot initiatives. So there is a groundswell of movement happening all across the United States.
And Kai Newkirk, the founding organizer of 99 Rise, this weekend you have a confluence of this day of action by money out voters in across the country. It also coincides, of course, with Martin Luther King's birthday. So
that's right.
It feels like there's a connection there, given how much money was poured into the $6 billion election we just had, and how many African Americans had their votes suppressed in the sense that they had to queue up forever to even vote. So do you feel that this is important timing, and can these two movements merge over this weekend?
Yeah, I definitely think so. I mean, both of these are examples of an attack on our democracy, whether it's the corruption of big money or these efforts to suppress votes, particularly the votes of people of color and poor people. And they're also attacks on the legacy and the life work of Martin Luther King Jr. I think it's a coincidence that Citizens United, the Supreme Court decision, was decided on Martin Luther King Jr. Day in 2010. But I think it's an opportunity for us to look into this question and realize that Martin Luther King's dream of peace and justice for everyone in our country, we're not going to be able to achieve that if we don't have a functioning democracy. And right now we don't, primarily because of this deepening corruption that big money has over our democracy. And for us in 99 Rise, there's another lesson there, which is that we think that we need to use strategic nonviolent action like was used in the civil rights movement in order to be able to move the public and win that change. And I think what we're seeing happening this weekend is another important step in that direction.
And Lauren Windsor, what are you going to be doing this weekend?
Well, we have organized a rally at City Hall with a great roster of speakers. I will be co-hosting with Mary Beth. Mary Beth will be the primary host with Kathy Fing, the executive director of Common Cause, who was also a vital key player in Wednesday's victory. And Julie Cronheim, who is an organizer with the California Common Cause, initiated this endeavor with the city council. So Mary Beth, Kathy, David DeGraw, who's an Occupy author and activist, will be speaking. Jimmy Dore, who has a show here on KPFK and who is a fellow Young Turk, will be speaking. We have Trent Lang, who is the executive director of the California Clean Money Campaign. Sheila Mickelson, who is the executive director of the Westchester Democratic Club. Members of Kai's organization, 99 Rise, we have some performances from Guido Corleone of the Luminaries. It's a rap group. Also, rapper Will Bannister.
But this is one of
Paulina Gonzalez. There's 76.
Yeah, but there's 76 cities involved in this day of action, right? In 33 states.
Yeah. So you know, for us in LA, we're just trying to, I think, lead the way, be a vanguard for the movement. As we were talking about earlier with the ballot initiative, the reason why it's important that LA weighs in on the issue is that this federal movement to actually call for a constitutional amendment, I mean, the scope of that, the scale of an undertaking that big is so huge that you can't just jump into it at the federal level. We've got to exert pressure on our politicians, and the way that we do that is through just building, like chipping away at the block and saying, you know, we have people at the local level, at the municipal level, at the state level, that all are in support of this. So, you know, it's really going to make federal legislators take notice when, you know, we're successful, like just knocking down the dominoes. And no campaign, I mean, no grassroots campaign is going to move forward without doing that hard work of building the movement. That's why the work that we all do is so important. We're all so passionate about it, is, you know, these small victories.
So, Mary Beth Fielder, tell me about the paths. If you mentioned how there's quite a number of Congress people have signed on to the constitutional amendment. That is one path. It's a long path. The founding fathers set a pretty high bar there. 2/3 of the legislatures and 2/3 of the states have to pass it. We know how long it took the ERA to get there, and it almost got there, but the Mormons shot it down at the last minute. So it's a long battle. There's also, of course, the legislative route as well through legislation, even though the Disclose Act was shot down pretty much after Citizens United because of the Republicans in the Congress refused to go along with it. There's also a tremendous vacuum at the Federal Elections Commission. I mean, Obama hasn't got several appointments he could make. I mean, they could do something instead of doing nothing or actively fighting against it. So give me a sense of the various parts of this menu of possibility that's out there.
I'll talk a little bit about the second option that you talked about, which is the legislative approach to it. There is legislation called the American Anti-Corruption Act that was crafted by Lawrence Lessig, had a role in it, Trevor Potter. And it is a comprehensive package. Right now, an organization, United Republic, and the campaign is called Represent.us, is working to get 1 million citizen co-signers and I think they have something like 350,000. The idea is that in the spring, as soon as there is this 1 million people, and I'm hope that this show today will bring in a few more 100,000 who might be listening, who will go to Represent Us and sign up to be a citizen co-sponsor. But it's going to be introduced hopefully in the spring, a left-right-center coalition. It really does a lot to address the whole issue of lobbying and the influence industry. Closing the revolving door relates to enforcement, as you were just talking with the FEC, disclosure. So it's kind of a, you know, these guys got together and really have put together a comprehensive take it or leave it is the idea behind the strategy, piece of legislation that we're hoping that the American people get behind, and that's the American Anti-Corruption Act. In terms of what you were talking about, the long haul for the constitutional amendment, you know, I'm personally hoping it's not as long of a haul as some of these other constitutional amendments. I think we live in the digital age, and there's tremendous opportunity for something to go viral and us to make progress much quicker. It's even conceivable that if we make a lot of progress this summer building the movement, that we might be able to really mount a campaign to unseat candidates who don't support it in 2014 and really change the composition of Congress so that we do get that 2/3 majority that we need to introduce the amendment. We are working nationally and in California to get all Congress people and state legislators on record either for an amendment or against it, so that we know who we need to unseat. And we are planning to wage campaigns against those who don't support it. I'm personally working on developing an internet tool that might would be able to use game mechanics to help this campaign go viral. So we'll see how that goes. But there is a hope that we might even, if we set this as our goal, be able to succeed at this by 2016. In fact, we did a conference in November, and at the end of that, we put forth a challenge for us to come together and to figure out, you know, if we had to do it, how could we do it, and to actually then enact that strategy, so how we could be clean by 16.
So, Kai Newkirk, again, the Los Angeles-based former union and community organizer and founding organizer of 99 Rise.
One of them, anyway.
One of them. So, tell me, though, about your idea of nonviolent, apropos Martin Luther King holiday this weekend, which coincides with the National Day of Action. Just tell us what that means in terms of this issue versus civil disobedience in civil rights, in terms of the new civil rights, the new struggle over getting rid of Citizens United.
Well, I think, you know, what Mary was talking about and what we've been talking about, this sort of slow pace of change, the 19th Amendment, which is how women got the right to vote, that took 90 years to win. The 26th Amendment, that lowered the voting age to 18, that happened in a matter of a few years in response to the activism of students and young people around the Vietnam War. And we're seeing not only just because of, you know, we're in the digital age and communication happens faster, like Mary Beth was talking about, but because around the world we're seeing an explosion of innovations in strategic nonviolent movements, whether it's Egypt or Tunisia or the Occupy movement, which shifted the entire debate in our country within a matter of weeks, right? So we know that just like in the civil rights movement, people use these moments when people put their bodies on the line and they made deep personal sacrifices. It's great to sign a petition. It's great to go to City Hall, like I was there with other folks advocating for this resolution. But there come times when we have to be willing to make a deeper sacrifice. And that's what moves the conscience of people and can move the conscience of a nation to take action at a stronger level.
So who would accelerate the
pace of change?
But when you take action, you know, if it's in the civil rights movement, it's the big fat white Southern cops with the German Shepherd dogs and their shotguns and the tear gas. That's the image. Who do you take action against in this case? The Koch brothers?
Well, there are many potential targets. The biggest ones are really the corporations that are really driving this process of corrupting our democracy. And at a certain point in time, it's going to have to be the elected officials that are standing against the will of their constituents and stopping change. This past election season, young folks in 99 Rise did sit-ins at Wall Street banks in New York and Los Angeles. These are small actions that we're calling on them just to reveal the truth about their dark money, their secret political expenditures. And they refused to do that and had these folks arrested just because they were trying to get the truth for the American people. And that's what moves the folks that are their classmates or their parents and other folks who hear about this to take this issue more seriously and makes the public focus on how far these corporations will go to protect this power to corrupt our democracy. And in the case of when we have to target elected officials, how far they will go to, refuse to follow the will of the people. And what we need to do this coming year in 2013 is we need to take this action from a small scale, these small sit-ins, to the scale of mass civil disobedience. And we're trying to get 10,000 people across the country to sign up to pledge that they'll do a day of mass civil disobedience to get money out of politics this year, we hope. Which would be the largest civil disobedience action in the history of the country. Folks can go to 99rise.org and pledge to be part of that. And we know if we do that, just like we saw the Occupy movement shift the conversation in this country, if we do that, we can put the question of the corruption of our democracy by big money at the top of the agenda in our country. We can accelerate the pace of change because we're in a crisis. We can't afford to wait, in my view, 4 years, 6 years, 8 years to see this change, whether it's climate change or how many lives are being ruined by the prison industrial complex or the fact that folks still can't get a job or afford college.
Medicine.
We're in a crisis. Healthcare. There are things that we need to change, and we need to change them now. And this question is the roadblock to all the progressive change that so many people want and need to see in this country. So I think, and everybody that's come together in 99 Rise and so many other feel like it's time to take action at a higher level to make deeper sacrifices so we can win change and win it now.
And Lauren, your generation, the millennials, right? Is that right?
No, I'm not the millennial.
You're a little over that?
Sure you are. You just slip in there just like me.
You look like you're...
You should never ask a lady her
teenager,
age,
for God's sake.
I know you're foreign, but
come on. Okay. So, you're certainly younger than I am, shall we say. Now,
fair enough.
The point being that how you're engaging your generation through the Young Turks Network and through your show, The Undercurrent. And your generation's strapped with student debt. There are these rip-off for-profit colleges that are just bleeding kids and leaving them with bankruptcy and worthless diplomas. There's the lack of prospects of jobs. When I went downtown to interview the Occupy people, there was a real echo of a lot of these issues amongst the young. How are you organizing your generation? Because there's always been a sense that there's been a big lull since the Vietnam War, and maybe one of these days there's going to be a similar kind of movement on that scale to change the politics of this country.
Well, I'm glad that you asked that, but may I like interject before I get to that question, just because I wanted to bring
point
up something.
Point of privilege, right?
Sorry.
Very parliamentary here. Okay.
I promise I will answer it like right after, but when you brought up the FEC with Mary Beth, mm-hmm. I think that it's important that people know that the makeup of the FEC, there's six commissioners, three Democrats and three Republicans, and it's chronically understaffed and underfunded. So we wonder why there's no movement forward with anything. And the same case being with like a similar position with the ATF, that there's been no director. You know,
we know why that's happened, because of the NRA.
Well, right. But you see this entrenched
It's political sabotage.
Incumbency of power that they benefit by it being constructed in the way that it is. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, it should be no surprise that the Federal Election Commission isn't, you know, being more active in actually, you know, doing anything to have better disclosure or, you know, migrate more towards public campaign financing. In terms of holding politicians accountable across the country, I put it this way. I don't know that Mary Beth likes the analogy, but I say that we're trying to be the Grover Norquist of the Citizens United movement. Essentially, you know, craft a pledge and get people to sign on and really hold people accountable. Like, we will not forget. You know, we do not forget. We will come after you. We will organize people to vote against you if you do not support. I mean, this is a nonpartisan issue. This is something that conservatives, libertarians, liberals alike should all be in support of. To get back to your question, though, I really see what you're talking about as the death of the American dream, that my generation, the millennial generation as well and younger, we grew up on all these promises of, you know, go to school, get a college education, and you'll be fine. And then we come out and we see that that's not the case whatsoever. I think for us, it's making the issue sexy. I think that you have to frame the debate in ways that are appealing and use unconventional strategies to get people on board.
And I think our generation is beginning to stand up. I mean, we're seeing it occupy the Obama campaign across the board.
Well, I'm afraid we've run out of time here, and it's been a pleasure having you all in the studio, Mary Beth Fielder, Kai Newkirk, and Lauren Windsor.
Thanks, Ian.
Mary Beth Fielder is a founder of the Los Angeles Money Out Voters In Coalition, an affiliation of groups dedicated to overturning Citizens United and passing a constitutional amendment that would eliminate corporate personhood and institute public campaign financing. She spearheaded the successful campaign to get the Los Angeles City Council to endorse this constitutional amendment. Kai Newkirk is a Los Angeles-based former union and community organizer. He is a founding organizer of 99 Rise, a movement dedicated to getting money out of politics. And Lauren Windsor is a multimedia journalist who blogs under the name Lady Libertine. She's also the host and producer of The Undercurrent, a grassroots political TV web show on the Young Turks Network. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And the conversation continues on facebook.com/ianmastersmedia. And I'll be back again on Sunday at 11 a.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. The headline reads